Hey everyone, welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week podcast hosted by three mega brains. Myself, Patrick Barney, and co-hosts Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. This episode we're discussing Atonement, the famous novel by Ian McEwan. Atonement follows the intertwined lives of Bryony Tallis, her sister Cecilia Tallis, and Cecilia's love interest, Robbie Turner. Before offering a synopsis of the novel, I want to urge listeners to stop listening now if you haven't read the book or at least seen the movie. This is a book that you don't want to spoil. Like, you really, if the book gets spoiled, it really kind of ruins everything. So don't keep listening if you aren't familiar with the ending of the book. So, spoiler alert. At a family gathering on a hot summer day in 1935, Cecilia and Robbie, young adults in their early 20s, try to work out their feelings for one another after growing up as friends. Meanwhile, Bryony, a 13-year-old girl prone to flights of fancy, tries to get her cousins enlisted as actors in a play she has written. As the day progresses, Bryony watches Robbie and Cecilia from afar, ultimately coming to believe that Robbie is a sexual predator bent on harming Cecilia. In reality, Cecilia and Robbie are coming to understand that they are in love. However, Bryony accidentally discovers Robbie and Cecilia in flagrante delicto, which the girl interprets as a rape. Later that evening, during a search for two cousins who have run away in a fit of sadness and anger, Bryony comes across her cousin Lola, who seems dazed and scared, and Bryony sees a shadowy figure running away into the forest. Convinced that Robbie has struck again, this time raping Lola, Bryony testifies to everyone who will listen, first her family, then the police, that she saw Robbie running away after abusing Lola. She persists through numerous interrogations, getting Robbie, who has been innocently searching for the missing cousins, arrested and sentenced to prison. So now the novel jumps forward in time to 1940, where we follow Robbie and two fellow soldiers, Nettle and Mace, as they retreat from, I believe it's the Battle of France, to the evacuation point at Dunkirk. Robbie recalls his arrest and imprisonment, his letters to Cecilia, in which they promise undying love for one another, and his choice to join the army in exchange for an early release. Though he has communicated with Cecilia by letters over the years, he has only gotten to see her once the whole time, and his entire existence is now bent on surviving the war so that he can get back to her. Robbie, over the course of a night and a day, makes his way to Dunkirk, but he is suffering from a shrapnel wound that appears to be infected as he develops a fever about the time he and Mason Nettle get to the Dunkirk beaches. He finds shelter with his two friends to wait for the arrival of British ships, which will take them to safety. Now the novel shifts away from him to Bryony after he appears to fall asleep. Bryony, over these 5 years, has come to a greater understanding of how royally she fucked over Robbie and Cecilia. In an effort to atone, she has become a nurse in training, and the novel follows her for a while as she cares for a number of terribly wounded soldiers who have arrived in London from Dunkirk. One notable character is a French boy who mistakes Bryony for a love interest, but when a bandage falls away from his head to reveal exposed brain, Bryony realizes the boy will soon die. Eventually, Bryony musters the courage to approach her older sister and try to apologize for ruining her and Robbie's lives. When she enters Cecilia's apartment, she realizes that Robbie is there, having just arrived home from Dunkirk. And though neither of them will forgive her, she does get a sense of peace from the knowledge that at least now Robbie and Cecilia will get to pursue a life together. At this point, the novel jumps ahead one more time, this time to the year 1999. So, you know, it's like 60 years later when Bryony is a 77-year-old famous novelist. In these final pages, the older Bryony reveals that what readers have been reading is actually the novel she wrote to atone for ruining Cecilia and Robbie's lives. In the novel she wrote, Robbie and Cecilia got a chance to see one another again, but in her older Bryony's reality, Robbie died of septicemia the night the novel leaves him, and Cecilia died 3 months later during the German bombing of London. They never got the chance to meet again, nor find out if they could build a life to one together. To try to make up for this fact, Bryony wrote the novel with a changed ending, hoping that by giving them a happy ending in literature, she could atone for sending an innocent man to prison and eventually death in war. So let's start with the funnest question. When I chose this book, Hans, you hung your head and washed your face with your hands and said, "Oh, fuck, I wish I was dead. I hate this book." At the time, you explained that maybe some of the personal stuff going on at the time when you first read the book might be why you hated it. So I want to ask, do you still hate it? And are there any aesthetic reasons for hating this book?
Yeah, there was great wailing and gnashing of teeth when you picked this. And having reread it, you know, the first time I read it was 13 years ago, and having reread it as a more thoughtful, mature person, you know, I do have to admit that from an objective standpoint, it's a very good novel, right? Like, if you think about what, like, quote-unquote good fiction does, I mean, it has an enormous amount of interesting creative detail, and the narration has this kind of richness to it. The prose is all very carefully, immaculately written, with all the kind of qualities of good fictional prose. The characters have layers and dimensions and feel authentic as people, and the plot is very surprising the first time you read it, although I did remember it well enough not to have any plot suspense this time. And right, there's a little metafictional twist at the end that makes it, you know, feel a bit experimental in a way that does not detract from any normal person's ability to read the book. So it is objectively a very, very good book, and I really can't imagine dissuading anybody from that through any kind of rational argumentation. I still fucking hate it.
Now, okay, so you...
Here's what I hate about it. Here's what I hate about it. I think that it is... I just find it... Oh, gosh. It's not... I don't find it dislikable exactly. I just find it deeply, profoundly boring, right? Because it's just
deeply,
so
profoundly what?
Boring.
Oh, boring. Boring. Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, to some extent, maybe if I were reading it fresh for the first time without knowing what happens, maybe that would have been different, right? Like, I did remember the plot from when I read it 13 years ago. But there's actually, like, there was no plot suspense going through it. And it is, there's really a pretty minimal amount of plot suspended in this kind of giant bath of warm, good writing. And it just, I think more than anything, there's just a humorlessness to it.
Yes, that agree.
Is, to me, felt oppressive, right? Like, it is.
Sure.
And I guess there are things that, it's not even that it lacks wit, right? It's not that it lacks wit. It's not that it lacks cleverness. But there is a kind of stone-facedness to it at all times that... Sure. I just found, I think the combination of the humorlessness plus, I don't know, there's something about flaws that make a work interesting, right? Because there's a certain amount of mental effort involved in kind of like, when you know that something is good in some ways and maybe flawed in others by conventional metrics, there's something, there's some additional level of thought that you have as a reader in kind of trying to sort that out as you go. And when it just very quickly reveals itself as both flawless and totally unfun, then, man, it's just 400 pages of trudge, you know? Mm. And I wouldn't expect anybody else to have that feeling, right? Like, I would imagine most people who read this who have a reasonably refined sensibility or not a reasonably refined sensibility would think it was very moving and very beautiful and very just amazingly well done. And somehow that's all true, and yet I just found it insufferably dull.
Sure. I think that's fair. I mean, I think it's fair in the sense that it is not a humorous novel, and you know, I can totally see why you wouldn't, like, as an experience, I can see why, like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily come away from this novel like, I loved that experience or anything like that. So I get it. Chris.
Yeah, I kept thinking about something like Money by Martin Amis, right? Or
right.
We didn't read this for the podcast, but The Line of Beauty by Alan Hollingsworth. Line of Beauty might be a better comparison, right? Because like, Line of, you know, Money is such a bizarre novel and Amis is so thoroughly his own thing. But like, a few years ago, I read something called Line of Beauty by Alan Hollingsworth, which is a novel about a closeted gay man who works in conservative politics during the Thatcher era in Britain. And it has a similar scale. It has a similar kind of moral weight to it. It has a similar level of sort of that kind of like endless thick layers of perfectly written English prose, you know, but it has this just layer of silliness that it dips into sometimes, right? Like, this is kind of almost an embarrassing example in a way, but there's like a scene in Line of Beauty where the protagonist and his boyfriend they've met a Spanish waiter and they're essentially paying him for sex. And at some point, and they're all doing coke, and at some point the Spanish waiter says, I hope these drugs don't make my dicky go soft. And the protagonist and his boyfriend just look at each other like, Jesus, who are we associating with? And I don't know, like, I wanted somebody in this book to say, I hope these drugs don't make my dicky go soft. And in the, yeah, that's what it needed. So,
What's your take, Chris?
Again, I don't expect anybody in the whole world to share my opinion here, right? Oh. I don't think I'm going to convince you of this.
I share your opinion, Hans, pretty much exactly. I think that it is a extremely well-crafted object. And there's nothing... I guess, if he was workshopping this, there would be nothing to do with it, right? It is what it's going to be. Like, it has found its final form and there's no refinement, but there's something fundamentally like in its most like foundational thrust.
That's what it needed. Foundational thrust. That's what the novel needed.
It needed a little. It just is the self-seriousness, Hans, is to me like a lack of playfulness with kind of the central metafictional twist, right? There's like nothing, like reading through it a second time is particularly terrible, I think, because I knew what was coming. And I didn't, it's just all like, what are you supposed to do? Like, knowing what's coming other than admire it for its, you know, prettiness and for its, again, like really well-crafted, qualities. It doesn't do more, I don't think. But go ahead, Patrick.
Well, maybe this is a good point to ask my second question. My reaction is different. I think this novel's great. I think both of you have a perverse attachment to novels that are deeply, deeply ironic. And irony's good. I like irony. I mean, in a good novel, but that doesn't mean I can't have a serious novel and think it's fun and be okay with a serious novel. That seems okay to me.
How dare you? How dare you? Like, I hope you give me a time to respond to that libel. But go ahead.
That you guys are perverse.
Continue your thought. I will rain fire upon thee. Keep going.
Well, so like, Chris, you're saying that there's nothing to do with it. There's nothing to think about. Like, it's solved. And I don't think that's true at all. Like, one thing that the ending of this novel invites us to do, at least implicitly, is to choose the ending we like the best, right? If the novel contains two novels, essentially, we start out reading novel B, which we don't know is novel B, at least not our first time around. And then at the end of the novel, we graduate up to novel A, right? They're both fictions. Novel A is where, old Bryony reveals that, well, this is the novel I wrote in which they lived. And novel A, this other novel that contains novel B, is a novel where they died. So it seems really similar to, let's say The French Lieutenant's Woman. Now, of course, The French Lieutenant's Woman is humorous and does have a sense of humor. But, don't you find that intriguing? Like, the idea that we can choose the ending we like?
I find that what it does is it, and I've thought about The French Lieutenant's Woman is a good comparison, right? And I think that we all found that ending to be the weakest part of The French Lieutenant's Woman,
right,
if I remember right. And I don't think that any of us had a good argument for how it serves the work to do that.
Right, right, right. I agree.
And I think actually, and this is one place where you can make an argument for Atonement, again, being a better novel, right? Because there's a character decision involved in the metafictional ending, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
It gives us a sense of the kind of emotional fullness of the old Bryony Talis. And I think that it, again, it's a way in which this is objectively, basically a flawless novel, right? It is the metafictional trick both changes what's come before and serves a character purpose. But it also has the effect of, it makes me think a bit about, I was in a class, and I think, Chris, you might have been in this class. I can't remember if you were Patrick, but we read Living in the Maniototo by Janet Frame, right? And in that book, there's a sequence that happens that is later revealed to have been the creation of, it's pretty much like this, right? It's a novel within a novel, except that it's a portion rather than the whole novel, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember somebody in that class said something like, I got to that point and I was like, oh, that was just a story? And then I thought, well, wait, it's all just a story. And then I thought, well, why do we care about any of this, right? There's something about that trick of like, haha, you cared about that, but it's a made-up story, that kind of then makes you go, well, I guess it's all a made-up story. And it kind of ends up, for me, reducing the emotional involvement I feel in the whole thing rather than enhancing it, right? Because it's like it points to the artificiality in a way that becomes nullifying. And, you know, like the idea that this invites us to choose what we like best, on some level, that's true, right? I mean, I guess it's a way, and again, good novel, right? Like, it's a way of thinking about the aesthetic priorities we bring to a work, right? Do I value a happy ending, or do I value something that has the tragic realism of lived experience, right? Like, okay, that is an interesting question, right? And again, I appreciate the work. It is still imposing a hierarchy of truth within the realm of the universe of the novel, right?
Sure.
It's not like we are actually choosing. There is a thing that is true and a thing that is a lie. And so I appreciate it. And I don't know that experience enhanced my sense of reading the work.
Yeah. Bryony, the author's point at the end too, is that, almost a reverse on that hierarchy, which is that, the truth won't matter at some point. It will become, you know, the story will be how things are remembered. So there, I guess there is, an interesting thing there where like that hierarchy that you suggest, Hans, is kind of complicated. It's just that I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know if I feel the same way, Patrick, that there's two novels for the price of one. I feel like there is a vessel that is kind of, there's a vessel created by the two like storylines, you know, the one that we read and the one that we are just sort of we glimpse at the very end. There's something created between those two that I don't know what to do with. And that's the type of like intellectual work I like to do with a metafictional novel, is like the connections, the resonances between, you know, the different frames that shouldn't be occupying the same space, right? That, I think that's one way of describing a metafictional novel, is like you are putting two frames that don't really belong on the same dimensional plane alongside one another, or allowing them to even sort of ingress on each other's frame a little bit. Martin Amis is an interesting one, because I was thinking like Martin Amis would write this where I believe Amis does this, right? Where Amis himself appears in his novels and will talk with one of the characters. So like Amis would be talking with Bryony about her novel and while she's writing her novel, but I just don't know what to. I like the intellectual play that's created by a tension between two stories that shouldn't, again, belong in the same place. But I don't know what to do with that here. And in the end, it feels a bit like, it feels a bit just like a rug pull, almost like, you know, oh, it's all a dream. And yeah. And I don't know. I it's all story. Like, there's not really any difference between the story as we're told it and the story as we learn it at the end, in terms of like its nearness to reality, but you know, I still kind of, I don't know, I guess like, am I supposed to be reacting frustrated like this? Is that like the purpose of this novel? I guess fundamentally don't appreciate that, that shift at the end. And I definitely don't appreciate reading it in anticipation of that shift.
Mm.
I think that like the rug pull that you talk about, Chris, right? I guess like as a reader, your first instinct is to go, oh no, poor Cecilia and Robbie, they didn't get their happy ending. And then you go, well, fuck, it's all just a story anyway.
Yeah, you're right that it diminishes everything. It does the same for me. Sorry, yeah, Hans, I interrupted.
It diminishes the impact of the betrayal of the characters that it's trying to perpetrate that should have an emotional impact, right? It diminishes, you end up in a feeling, you end up in a sense of feeling less emotional investment, both in the happy ending and in the unhappy ending.
Oh, man, I just totally disagree. I think the ending just elevates the novel to a Shakespearean tragedy. In fact, so much of the novel is like based on the idea of like a series of events that have to be a certain way, or there's a shift and things turn out better. And that's the same type of that's typically the same type of feeling you get when you are watching or reading a Shakespeare play, the tragedies especially. So basically, I feel like the novel is, at least on me, it's super successful at just making me totally fucking depressed. and like that's, you know, that's what it should do. Like, it's all right to be depressed by a novel sometimes, you know. I remember I saw the film first, and then years, in fact, there's actually a good story. There's a good story here about why we're
is it better than Atonement, the story that we're about to hear?
Well, I would say no, but it might be better for you since you didn't like it. But the tragedy that you guys had to read this again, the reason why that happened is a series of uncanny events. So I think it's interesting that there's a parallel there. Basically, if I hadn't been listening to a novel on Audible in my car, you guys would not have to deal with this right now. And I'm sure that you wish that I hadn't been. But basically, I'd been listening to a novel in my car, and it just so happened that the novel ended, and Audible automatically plays a sample of some other novel that it thinks you might like. And at any other time where my phone is readily available, I press pause or stop because I don't want any recommendations from Audible, because fuck your algorithm. I don't care if it can suggest a novel that I'd like. I don't want it to. But anyway, so it starts reading the first chapter of another novel by Ian McEwan, What We Can Know. And I was like, huh, Ian McEwan, wasn't that the guy who wrote Atonement? And I'm listening and I'm like, wow, this is great. I like what's happening. So I ended up reading that book, or listening to it, What We Can Know. Thought it was really good. And then I was like, all right, let's go back and read Atonement. So I did that, and I really liked it. And I was like, man, this would be cool to talk about, because we had just talked about all this. First, we had talked about what was it? Will There Ever Be Another You, which is basically nonfiction masquerading as fiction. And then, Hans, you picked those pieces that are fiction masquerading as nonfiction, and so I thought it'd be a good follow-up. So that's the series of unfortunate events that led to this tragedy that you guys had to reread it. So I apologize for
It's even more unfortunate, actually, because I really want to read What We Can Know. Like, I have that on my list of things to read in the near future, and was kind of excited about the idea of reading it. And if you had just picked What We Can Know, which was the first thing that the algorithm suggested to you, I would have been ecstatic.
Oh, I'm sorry, man.
I've been so happy. And now I'm probably not going to read that book because I'm so mad at Ian McEwan for
sure.
twice well, in my life thrusting atonement into my past.
Well, maybe I'll pick it sometime because I really liked it. Like, I almost was like, why don't we just do What We Can Know? But then, like, I had read Atonement right after What We Can Know, and I was like, all right, let's do Atonement. What We Can Know is, I really like What We Can Know. But
still look forward to reading it.
Yeah, you don't have to go out of your way to pick it, because I bet you I will pick it at some point. But anyway, all I was saying is I think that like I can totally understand if you get to the end of this novel, it's super depressing, you end up super depressed, and like, shit, I really didn't want to feel this way. And so I would have preferred if I hadn't read this book. The idea that it like is less emotionally resonant, you know, there's another question I have about like metafiction in general. Like, so like something like If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler. Now that book leaves me totally emotionally dead. And like Chris, and it's you were saying that it's you weren't saying anything, but like it seems to be an example of something closer to what you were talking about, where different frames of reference or different ideas that shouldn't be parallel or together are together in that novel. And I thought If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler's pretty bad and left me emotionally dead, but you both of you two liked it, right?
I think I liked it more than Hans. Yeah, I think Hans was
I don't remember liking it very much, actually.
Yeah. But oh, you didn't?
Yeah.
I mean, you can go check the tape and see what I said, but if I did say that I liked it, I feel like I might have been fronting a little bit for whatever reason.
I might have roofied Hans and convinced him, you know, in this sort of dream
well,
state.
I don't think that's how roofies work. Roofies don't convince you, right?
If roofies made people think that they liked a novel that they don't actually like, I would be a much more prolific user of roofies.
Right, exactly. Right. Like if that were something that a roofie could make you do, man, oh geez, imagine like how many novels you could read that you would just end up loving. Actually, I think there is already a drug that does that, and it's called weed. Weed. Yeah. I mean, it's true.
It is true.
You smoke some weed, and you go see a really bad movie, but because your brain is so dumbed down by weed, you think it's great. But, of course, when you're on weed, it's harder to read a novel. Like, that's harder to do, because you'd have to be able to, like, think.
Can I jump in? Because, like, you mentioned the ending again and about, like I think, actually, like, I really do love and am drawn to sincerity in novels. Kazu Ishiguro's The Buried Giant, or, you know, other ones that, like really like the ones that can drop irony and be like upfront and almost saccharine. I'm a sucker for that shit. But I think that's a fair thing to point out. Like, this is a very, like, when I say that I like that metafictional playfulness, it is like basically something that is, I don't know if ironic is the right term, but it is something that is playful and putting some distance between you, the reader, and some like consistent emotional arc, you know, that would be maybe more thoroughly explored in a linear narrative. And I don't know, maybe it is that I just find this novel a big old bummer. And it occurred to me when you said it, like, there's a movie actually A movie that I've never, everyone always sort of talks about how it's really great and how the ending is amazing. And it's a, and it actually was revised from the novel. It was an movie adaptation of a novel. And the author, Stephen King, really loves the ending too. The movie is The Mist. At the end of The Mist,
he, I hated that, like, that ending. I thought it was horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. You, and so, so like, to me, if we're not going to get, you know, I admire tragedy, but I admire tragedy for what it says about things. And this feels, it's trying to connect to endpoints in my brain that maybe they don't work or something like that. Because I, you know, as far as the work that The End of The Mist is doing, it feels like it's just sort of saying, you know, like,
that's kind of what I get out of it. Just fucking playing with you. Like that ending that's why I don't like that ending. Like that ending just is fucking playing with you for like thrills or to like have one final like stab. But if it were reversed and there was suddenly a happy ending out of nowhere, no one would accept it. No one would accept it at all.
Sure.
Like if they just luckily had a happy ending, you'd be like, oh, that's dumb. And I don't see any reason to think that an ending that is as brutal as The Mist's, for no reason, like that is just out of nowhere. Like I don't see any reason to think that's a good ending. Now, I don't think that criticism applies to this novel for one reason. Like Han said, it does serve a character arc. You know, deepens the idea of the questions about atonement that the novel kind of asks. Like my thought is that like it asks us to wonder more about like, well, is this attempt at atonement successful? Is it, you know, is there any way that atonement can even be had in a situation like this? So to me, it asks deep questions, works. But of course, you know, you were going to say, Chris, that you don't think it does, right?
So I read it going through a second time. Bryony is a fastidious, anal retentive character who enjoys who it's not even that she enjoys, she requires things to be just so.
Right.
And I feel like atonement is almost more accurate. I read it as more accurately. I read it as more a rationalization of this compulsion on her part to tie things up with a bow.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and
that's an interesting take on the ending too.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that was interesting. I think to carry me through the second reading of it. I guess it just sort of reminds me that I really don't like this character very much.
I did want to say on the podcast to our listeners that, you know, Chris, I said, here are my questions in the chat. And Chris was like, question number one, why is Bryony such a bitch? So I thought that was, you typed it more funnily, amusingly.
Yeah.
I forget exactly how you typed it, but I did think that was funny.
I don't want to dunk on this, you know, novel.
Well, you know, neither of you have dunked on it because you can't. But
it's
well, and I do think, Patrick, to be fair to your perspective, Patrick, you know, I don't. Earlier in the conversation, you accused myself and Chris of having a perversity that I'm somewhat paraphrasing, but you said that we're perverse. I think what you were trying to say is that we're perversely drawn to flawed novels and find conventional quality kind of ironically dull. And I do think that's probably true of me, right? Like,
go ahead.
Like conventionally defined merit, let's say, right? I do think that, like, we are probably, and maybe this is less true for Chris, right? Like, and everybody, on some level, like, everybody's always an unpredictable ecosystem, right? You know, everybody's taste is an unpredictable ecosystem. There are examples that you could find that would contradict whatever kind of cartoon you want to make of us, right?
Absolutely.
But I do think it's totally fair to accuse me of being a habitual obscurantist who is resentful of things that are inadequately esoteric.
Right.
I don't think that's... And that's why I've taken such pains to emphasize that, like, my dislike of the experience of rereading this is a very personal thing.
Right, 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 yeah.
That I would hold against, you know... Like, I think that... You're probably the most right of the three of us in this context. And even your point about it resembling a Shakespearean tragedy in the manner in which everything has to go a very particular narrow way to generate a, you know, broadly worst case outcome. That's totally true. Yeah. I 100% agree with that, and it doesn't make me like
the thing anymore. Right. Like, there's no way to like a novel that you just don't like, right?
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Hans, at the beginning, you were like, this is a good novel that I don't like. And I think that I probably said something similar about Omen Setter's Luck, right? Like, the Omen Setter's Luck, there's not any... There, like, if I tried to point out some aesthetic flaw in Omen Setter's Luck... I really wouldn't be able to. Where you like its obscurantism, I dislike its obscurantism. And yeah, there's nothing else to say about that, right? Like,
I have a question, actually.
Yeah.
For me? Just something I was thinking as, well, just for the both of us. And this is maybe, I don't know if this is too off topic or too big a conversation. There are two things that I was thinking, actually, about general aesthetic principles. One is, Chris, you had a slightly different definition of metafiction than I normally use, right? Like, I think of metafiction as being fiction which openly acknowledges its own fiction, its own existence as fiction, as a means of interrogating the nature of the medium rather than telling a conventionally engaging story. And I actually wonder if that was not, to a pretty great extent, a failed experiment. Like, how much stuff that does that do even the three of us really like? Like, the end of The French Lieutenant's Woman, I find to be... by far the weakest link in what's otherwise a really fantastic novel.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that, like, this is probably the best case scenario for it, I guess. But, like, if On a Winter's Night, a Traveler, like, I guess, Chris, you did enjoy that. But I don't know. Like, I do think that actually that might have been a little bit of a misbegotten impulse, which is strange for me to say because I spent at least grad school kind of compulsively swabbing the knob of that sort of thing. But I've really kind of come to think of that as...
I don't know why I found that so funny.
Mostly a counterproductive dead end. I don't know.
I don't...
The other thing I was going to say... No, well, you can... I wasn't sure if you had anything to say in response to that. It's such a sweeping generalization.
I was just going to say, for my part, that... Like, I don't think of metafiction as like a technique that I'm deeply interested in. I you know, I'm probably of the three of us, the way you guys have defined metafiction, like I'd say my idea of what metafiction is much looser. Like, it always seemed to me that any fiction that contains a fiction is employing a metafictional technique. And maybe that's not right. Maybe that is too loose. But just in general, like, I do like fictions that contain fictions. I typically think that the idea of a story within a story, like a character reading a story in a story, or a character telling another character a story within the story, I typically like that. I'm not exactly sure why. I think it's interesting. I think it's thought-provoking, and I do think maybe it is on the metafictional, like on the spectrum of metafiction, like as subtle as possible seems good, like less like all up in your face, like If a Winter's Night, a Traveler seems worse to me. But that, I guess that's my general response.
You asked a question that we didn't answer, which was you asked if you compared Atonement to you compared Atonement to If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, and right. You kind of suggested a taxonomy of types, right?
Right, yeah.
Atonement is one type of metafiction, and Winter's Night is another. And I think actually, I don't know if it's so much a matter of two types as it is a spectrum, right? Like
spectrum.
You made the point of how much does it call attention to itself?
Right.
And meaning, I think here, metafiction more in the sense that I was employing it of fiction which goes out of its way to emphasize, hey, this is a fiction, right?
Right.
For kind of structurally experimental purposes rather than narratively satisfying purposes. I think there's a spectrum of different works that do more or less of that, right? Atonement, there's a bit of that squeezed into the end.
Right.
If on a Winter's Night, a Traveler, it's like fundamental to the structural bones of the whole story and kind of impedes any other technique. So I think probably for me, the ideal would be somewhere like New York Trilogy by Paul Auster, mm-hmm. right? Which is similar in that it's a set of three novellas. We read this for the podcast,
right.
You know, I know you guys know this, but for the benefit of listeners who haven't read it, it's a set of three novellas. And we eventually learned that the first two novellas were written by the protagonist of the third novella, right? And I found that effective. It's not too different, I think, from what's happening here, but it calls somewhat more attention to itself, partly because you find out, I think, sooner in the kind of front-to-back arc of the thing, and partly also because you know, one thing that you mentioned also that we haven't really addressed is how much a first-time reader would have hints that something is happening that, and I don't think there are any hints at all. I think it's mm-hmm. entirely po-faced in that regard, right?
I think there's one hint.
What is the one hint?
Early in the novel, Bryony's looking at something, and it's described as leonine yellow. And then later in the rejection letter she gets, the character who wrote the rejection letter is the real life figure Cyril Connolly, who was an editor and who was friends with George Orwell when they were kids. Cyril Connolly in the letter, it says, "I really enjoyed that phrase, leonine yellow." So I think there is that one hint, but that was the only one that I could see.
Yeah, that is clever. But I think that's very different from, like, in New York Trilogy, the first two novellas are just mysterious in this fundamental way, right? There's this sense that you have reading them that they are working to some system of logic that is impenetrable. And they're kind of pleasurable in their own regard, in their own terms, just as these kind of like enigmas. But to then read the third and have a greater framework for that, I mean, I think there's much more of a sense you have reading the first two parts of that of what the fuck is going on.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you really have to be looking for that hint in Atonement.
You really have to be looking for that hint, even on a reread. Like, I was rereading it, and I didn't catch it myself.
Right. You know?
So I think that there's a spectrum, and if we want to put a value judgment on the spectrum, I would put something like New York Trilogy in the middle between Winter's Night and Atonement, and lean more toward the New York Trilogy value on the spectrum.
Right.
I believe I'll chime in to say I believe there's another very heavily metafictional text that we all actually I think enjoyed, The Garden of Seven Twilights.
Yeah, that was great.
That was
fucking whack.
It was whack, but it was, I think one of the things that we all liked about it too is that it actually was not trying to be sneaky in its metafictionalness. It was actually shorthand within it that helped you keep track of the stories within stories relative to other stories. And it was really actually trying to be transparent about that. And some metafiction gets really sort of up its own butt trying to, you know, make the reader feel like they're, you know, completely at sea. And that is the trick. And I think, you know, New York Trilogy is really, what you said about that, Hans, is that resonates really strongly with me. It's like, there is this kind of balance of feeling lost in something. When you feel lost, it's another way of, when I feel lost, it's a way of feeling present, I guess. Mm-hmm. Right. So like when I'm lost in something in a way, that, you know, I can't quite figure out the bounds of the space that I've been put in. And I don't know, all of the, you know, I just like that feeling. I like that sensation. And I think that really clarified for me, like with Atonement, like the thing that I struggled with, especially on a second read through is the ending is for me was so cantilevered out over the experience of reading it. It wasn't a feeling of being lost or of discovering. It was a feeling of, you know, just, you know, I wasn't present because I was waiting for the ending, I guess. And so, you know, maybe that's just, bad reading on my part. I don't know. Like I value good metafiction for how it can make me engaged with the present, with the actual process of reading line by line, because it takes away some of the other things that as a reader I can rely on to orient myself. And that sense is really, really powerful. When the metafiction is very Boolean, when it's like just an either or, it's, you know, this is true. It can feel cheap, it decoheres in quantum speak to a very simple reality, and I don't find that as compelling, but I recognize, you know, like talking about Atonement and reading it, that like I may be so distracted by the ending that I don't stay present while reading it, and that maybe hurts my appreciation of of real what is clearly really strong writing and a very moving story. I don't know about the spectrum of metafiction. Maybe it's maybe there's multiple axes on of metafiction, and down this particular axis where the coherent the there's no point at which these two stories, these two Briony's novel or what really happened are coherent at the same time. They're either one of them coheres, one of them or the other one is true. And for some reason that just knocks me out of the simple experience of the novel. And I don't get as much out of it.
You said something there, Chris, that I like a lot. Now, I don't even know if I have anything to add to it. I just want to make sure it gets acknowledged, which is that feeling lost is a way of feeling present for you. And that has a very nice poetic resonance to it that I think also very neatly sums up a lot of how I relate to art myself, right? So I just really wanted to kind of thank you for saying that, because I like that a lot. I did think a little bit about, you know, there's something about this novel where, like, and this is another thing I think that you could essentially point to as an aesthetic virtue, right? But you can kind of pay whatever level of attention you want to it and still be okay, you know? I think partly because it is relatively, like, the plot as such can actually be summed up very quickly. Like, you can, you know, there are so many words to say what is said, and you can, I think, really hang over every sentence, or you can kind of like skim at really kind of the maximum possible speed and actually come out the other end basically feeling like you know what happened, right? Which is like theoretically a virtue, I think, because it makes it accessible to people with different capabilities as readers. But at some point also it's an oddly frictionless experience. And that might be another thing that I struggled with, is like, I want to feel like I have to push a little bit, and you don't really feel like you do with this work, which I think again goes back to that sense of like lost, the feeling of lost being similar to a feeling of presence.
Well, I mean, I don't really have much to add to that. Like, my reactions were super different than your reactions. As we've said that our tastes are different. And there's nothing much to say. Like, basically all I'm saying is the only thing I would add is a disagreement. And, you know, like at this point, do we need to further disagree? Like, what else do
I'm happy you enjoyed it.
Well, yeah.
Like, I'm happy you had a positive aesthetic experience. I hope that doesn't sound condescending. I just...
Sounded a little condescending. But that's okay.
I was trying to end it on a positive note, you know?
Like, well,
I don't know. Like, it's...
We don't have to come to agreement for the podcast end on a positive note. I don't think, like,
Patrick is going to rewrite the whole podcast and say that we came to agreement. Sorry, that made more sense in my head. Doesn't quite make sense, but
like, I'm going to revise the whole, like, every time you guys say every time you guys say something that I disagree with, I'll just like edit to say, like, you know, Chris, the context for this is that Chris was actually saying he doesn't think this, or
yeah. I was thinking that you're kind of Briony in this case, because, you know, you'll be editing the podcast and you can edit it in,
yeah, I could,
and at the you could just like use AI for our names, like, and then at the end say, like, actually, this is what they really said.
Yeah, that'd be hilarious. Um, uh, But yeah, so basically to sum up, I thought it was great. You guys didn't enjoy it. And that even though, like you say, you know, that there are plenty of aesthetic, it has plenty of aesthetic virtues. And I think, Chris, you maybe thought, like Hans seemed to be like, yeah, it's on paper, it's a good book, I just didn't like it. But Chris, you may have thought that there were some actual flaws, like it was too simple, things like that.
No, I think it's a Hans's point is a good one. I think that, like, I think it is really a subjective response on my part that, like, you know, I don't actually mean to cook the whole thing down to something that's like The Mist, where the rug pull at the end is simply like mean-spirited. I think it is trying to explore things that and themes that they don't speak to me. So sure. It's a very subjective thing. I think it is. It's an incredibly well-crafted thing. You know, like it's like a really beautiful painting in a style that I would never hang in my home. So sure. I think
that's a good closing metaphor. I think that it works perfectly to sum everything up. So, Chris, your pick is next, correct?
Yeah, it is. And I've gone back and forth on this, and I can't remember. I forgot to check, actually. Let me look real quick to make sure that we didn't do this one already. I don't think we did.
That's really interesting that we're getting to a point where we can wonder that.
You know? Yeah. I want to do Inherent Vice.
We already did that.
Okay.
How dare you?
I've seen the movie, and I started to read the book, and I was like, oh, my God, fuck Pynchon. I was like, fuck,
Inherent Vice is, it's not as
Pynchon's an obscurantist bitch. Fuck it.
I don't think Inherent Vice is that bad, but
but my tolerance is super low. Like, you guys are talking about how you want to be lost. I'm like, no, fuck being lost. You are just, I'm not here to watch you stroke your fucking dick or, you know, flick your bean or whatever. Like, give me some.
I'm sorry, Patrick. Would you like me to pick something else? No.
I'm not. I, just like Hans was like, I'm not going to be that person. I am not going to be that person. I will read Inherent Vice, and I will do my best to appreciate it.
I was going to pick something that I hadn't read before. It's a debut novel by Andrew Gallix called Lauren Ipsum. I read a review of it and then I read an excerpt of it, and it's still something that I want to read, but I after reading the excerpt, I couldn't tell if the excerpt was, you know, just a fragment within the novel that, you know, he was going to be doing some other stuff. Because I felt like maybe if he was doing that throughout the whole novel, it'd be irritating as hell, but, still don't read that, but it kind of reminded me of Pynchon, and then I remembered Pynchon's newest novel just came out, but I read some reviews of that and I didn't want to prescribe that here either, so I jumped to Inherent Vice. That's my thought process on that, and I say we read the book and talk about the movie.
That's, if you guys fine are by me down. I've seen the movie, I'll watch it again.
I sometimes just pull up the scene where Martin Short, like, Joaquin Phoenix are doing coke in the giant Golden Tooth building, And then they all decide to go for like a drive together. There's this moment where like, it just turns and it's like one of my favorite cinematic moments, of the last 10 years. It's just fucking so funny. But
I
sorry,
think
Patrick.
I remember laughing my ass off when like the cop or the FBI guy who is gay, but doesn't necessarily know it, is like eating a huge chocolate banana, which
Bigfoot?
Is that the character's name?
I think so.
But you know, he's sucking on it. Bigfoot, like he is performing fellatio on a penis, which I thought was pretty funny, you know.
Yeah, I
actually
go ahead, Hans.
I think that, well, it's been a long time since I read Inherent Vice. I'm not sure I've read it since it first came out, actually. But I kind of have always felt like it actually works better as a movie. Like, it's one of the relatively small number of things that do. So it'll be interesting, I think, to talk about both. And it'll be interesting to go back to the text, having now a somewhat clearer sense of the story from, you know, having seen... I've probably seen the movie 3 or 4 times. So it's... It'll be interesting. I like this idea.
Cool.
All right, listeners. So this has been our discussion of Atonement, an excellent novel that my Philistine co-hosts didn't get with their small brains. And we're going to talk about Inherent Vice next time by Thomas Pynchon. Peace out until next time.